at one time, and there's a support group gathering, and it's a support group for people who are becoming like their fathers, or people who are becoming their fathers. And there's all these, you know, people sitting around, and they're just sort of sharing these random thoughts that come to their heads and that come out of their mouths that they can't control. And this one guy says, "Did somebody leave a door open? What are we trying to do, air condition the neighborhood?" And then somebody else says, "It's a perfectly good baseball hat. Why wouldn't I wear?" And my favorite one is, "You know, defense really does win championships." So that, I'm sorry, that's sort of the sports version of this other story that I'm going to share. But I heard about a church that held a weekend retreat for teens and their parents. And in one session, they had the parents and the teens meeting separately. And so in one session, it was just the students with a leader. And they asked the loaded question, "What's wrong with your parents?" So just imagine, you know, ask a random group of teenagers, "What's wrong with your parents?" And as you can imagine, they got quite a few responses. So they had this big whiteboard, and they were just writing all these things down. And this whiteboard was just filled with responses, like, "They are too demanding. They don't trust me. They don't listen to me. They hate my friends. They don't value my privacy." That's my favorite one. "They're always nagging." So had all the, you know, all these responses, and so at the end of the session, they leave the room and they go into another room where all the parents were meeting with leaders, and they see the parents have a whiteboard too, and they can see all of these responses that the parents had to the question, "What's wrong with your kids?" However, they can see, you know, on a whiteboard, you erase it, and it's never really completely gone until you use that magical liquid that sprays on there, and then everything disappears. So they can see that, you know, just the bare outline, they can't really read what they said. And over the top of it is this statement: "Our teenagers are so much like us." And I think that's really true. I don't know very many parents, myself included, who haven't said one time or another, "Ugh, I sound just like my father." And it's the ugh, you know, at the beginning, that, you know, that's not really a positive thing. It's human nature to observe the flaws in your parents. Unfortunately, it's also human nature, guess what, kids, to repeat the flaws of your parents and then come up with some of your own. So get ready. It's fun. So in 1 Kings, we run into a tension between two realities in a fallen world. The title of this series is Leadership in a Broken World. And so on the one hand, you have these two realities. On the one hand, the sins of the fathers often plague their children. And that's a reality you see all the way through Scripture, and you see it in our day today. On the other hand, the sins of the children often plague themselves. And we get both in spades in this book. It was a dark time. And by the way, there's an outline if you want to follow along in the worship bulletin. But thank goodness there is a light in the darkness. And up to this point, just to give you a little perspective, if you haven't been with us up to this point, we've had 18 sermons. That's quite a lot, isn't it? Congratulations. We've had 18 sermons, and we've studied the reigns of 2 kings in 18 sermons. That's an average of 9 each. Today, we're going to look at 3 kings in 30 minutes. So, you know, some of you might feel a little sense of relief, because the landscape's going to start moving a little faster. By the window in the train car, which might be good, because in this book, it's sort of like a New Hampshire winter. You know, it starts getting dark quickly. But also, you know, like life in New Hampshire, spring is coming. And we're really glad. Now, I know spring is actually technically here, but it's not really here until May. So for those of you that may have moved here, you know, and you were hoping something was going to happen on March 21st, like, boom, magical. No, not so much. But it'll come. So let's now read chapter 14, verses 21 to 31. This is the first section. "Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. And Judah did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed, more than all that their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. And there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. They did according to all the abominations of the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. In the fifth year of King Rehoboam, Shishak, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took away everything. He also took away all the shields of gold that Solomon had made, and King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze, and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of the Lord, the guard carried them and brought them back to the guard room. Now the rest of the acts of Rehoboam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam continually. And Rehoboam slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite, and Abijam his son reigned in his place. Now, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, you may remember we talked about Jeroboam already, but we didn't. We only talked about the very beginning of his reign. So he was the son of Solomon, and he was the one on whose watch the kingdom of Israel split into two. Ten tribes were in the north. They were called Israel. The two tribes in the south were called Judah. And, you know, you might have remembered that there was what precipitated that split, at least at the human level, was that Rehoboam refused to listen to the older men, the elders, the ones who had advised his father, who said, be a servant to the people. And instead, he listened to the younger men who, you know, grew up with him, and they said, hey, show them who's boss, essentially. But we learned something in this passage that we didn't know then. Did you notice something in those 10 verses? There was something that got repeated once at the beginning, once at the end. Rehoboam's mother and her ethnic heritage, ethnic, racial, religious heritage all in one, were mentioned twice, once at the beginning and once at the end. And, you know, you all know, I've said this a million times, the Bible doesn't repeat things just to make, you know, fill up space. There's plenty of material. The Bible repeats things for emphasis. And so Rehoboam did not listen to these older men, but he did listen to one older woman in his life, and she happened to be one of the pagan wives of Solomon. And obviously she had influenced him, because all the practices that Solomon carried on at the end of his life, at the end of his reign, Rehoboam carried these on. And you know, many would say that he actually enhanced them, increased them. You had alternate religious shrines. That's what the high places were, basically places for people to worship whatever god they chose. They were all over the country. There were pillars, which were essentially symbols of male deities in Canaanite fertility worship. You had Asherah poles, which were symbolic of the female goddess who was the consort of Baal. There were shrine prostitutes. It mentions male. The grammar basically leads us to believe that we're male and female shrine prostitutes who served the worshippers. So, you know, you can't, really, even at this early date, you can't tell much of a difference between Judah's worship and the worship of the nations around them. So so we see that last week we talked about Jeroboam's golden calf. That was a problem, a big problem, but it wasn't the only problem with God's people. So Rehoboam, he's the king, right? He's the spiritual leader of Judah. He carries a lot of responsibility. But what you need to notice is that in verse 22, the writer doesn't mention his name. He doesn't say the sins of Rehoboam. He says the sins of Judah. So he actually holds the nation responsible, not just Rehoboam. And those three verses, 22 to 24, are what some scholars call a programmatic text. So it looks beyond just this situation that it's in. It sort of broadens out and actually looks to the future. If you remember, if you were here last week, we talked about God's judgment on Jeroboam and how it actually looked ahead to the fact that Israel was going to be carried off and they were going to cease to exist as a nation. And that happened, but it happened a lot later than Jeroboam's reign. He was the first king. So that same thing happens in this text here about the southern kingdom. It's not as specific. But the fact that it says the nations, it refers to the nations that the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. It's referring to the Canaanites. Essentially, he's implying that's going to happen to Judah too. They're going to be driven out because they're doing the same things. God is, you know, when he called his people Israel, he didn't pick them because he liked them the best. You know, this wasn't favoritism. He chose to set his name on this people. And he wasn't going to treat them. In fact, you know, he had a high standard for them. And so if they were doing the same things the Canaanites were doing, they were going to be held accountable. In fact, they had the law. The Canaanites didn't have the law. So it's a dark time, and the darkness of the people's sin was going to have to be judged. So that judgment was going to come in stages, and the first stage actually happens right in this passage. 5 years into Rehoboam's reign, the ruler of Egypt, Shishak, attacked Jerusalem. He was also called Shoshank the First. He was founder of the 22nd dynasty. He was not Egyptian. He was Libyan. And he married into Egyptian royalty, but he was a man of incredible talent, a man of unparalleled. His ambition matched his talent. And when you get those two together, you know, watch out. And that's what happened. He consolidated his power very quickly in Egypt, and then he moved north. And on one military campaign, he destroyed 150 cities, or conquered, I should say, conquered 150 cities. And many of those were in Judah, in Israel. It's possible, probably actually likely, he didn't actually destroy Jerusalem. He basically came up to the gates, and they realized, okay, we're done for, unless something happens. And so Rehoboam surrendered all of this gold, and that was basically tribute, and that bought him off, and so he didn't attack. We find out from Chronicles. So if you're in your Bible and you see you've got, okay, 1 Kings, 2 Kings, right after that you have 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles. Well, these are parallel books, and so they have different goals in mind. The writers have different intentions, but you have a lot of information in Chronicles that isn't in Kings and vice versa. So it's helpful to go back and forth. And I'm not necessarily planning on preaching Chronicles right after Kings, just so you know. Probably breathing a sigh of relief. But I am going to refer, because I think it's very helpful. So Chronicles tells us that Rehoboam only repented when Shemaiah the prophet rebuked him. So, you know, this wasn't something that Rehoboam, you know, really initiated. He was kind of shamed into it. And so they got peace, but peace was very, very expensive. All of the gold objects, you know, that filled the temple, that made Jerusalem this glittering city on a hill, it was all gone. And it all, ironically, went back to Egypt. Now, why is that ironic? Well, remember when they came out of Egypt in the Exodus, they brought all this gold stuff with them, all these, you know, earrings and brooches and all this jewelry and precious gems. And all the loot goes back. And you know what? Then it's going to come back again. Then it's going to go back. And it comes and it goes. That's what happens. But the sad thing about Rehoboam and his response was that he didn't seem to see the connection between his idolatry, his false worship, and Egypt's thievery, taking all of this stuff. But what was his response? You know, he didn't say, "Oh Lord, I've sinned. This is terrible. I can't believe." No, he had bronze shields made to replace the gold shields, and so, you know. Yeah, bronze isn't quite as valuable as gold, but, you know, hey, the show must go on. So let's just, you know, we want to keep up the appearances that everything seems to be just the way it was, just a little bit less gold. No big deal. Who needs gold anyway? We got bronze. And it's sort of symptomatic of what was wrong with Rehoboam and the entire country. Let's just pretend that everything is the way it was. And pretend that this bad event didn't happen, rather than getting to the heart of the matter, which is his heart and the hearts of the people. We talked last week, I mentioned how in America we have a lot of churches that have gorgeous buildings and you know, beautiful choirs and all kinds of accoutrements that are a lot, you know, nicer than ours. You know, this is not exactly a cathedral, but we like it. And you know what? We don't have to get outside and paint the trim. That's what I like the best. So betraying my former profession, but you have a lot of gorgeous houses of worship in America that are absolutely empty when it comes to what counts, which is the gospel. The heart of the church is the gospel. That is the essence of the church. That's what changes our hearts and makes us followers of Jesus. I had an office mate once for a few years who was a member of a large church, kind of a mainline church, and we used to talk about a lot of things, but he couldn't understand for the life of him why people would come to the church and raise their kids in the church, and then the second their kids graduated from high school, the people were gone. And he was like, what's the deal? What are you just going to church for your kids? And I was like, preach it. And but he stayed in the church. You know, his kids graduated, he stayed, he was very committed, he was a member of the trustees, and he would complain about how much of the endowment they had to spend in order to keep all those massive buildings, you know, heated and in good repair, and how attendance was dwindling year by year. But whenever I would try to steer the conversation around to the gospel, and we talked a lot about the gospel. I was there when the Passion of the Christ movie came out, and we talked about that. But it's like every time we got to the actual gospel, it was like I was talking to a man made of Teflon. It was like everything went ping, 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 and it just bounced off, and it just didn't seem to sink in. The one verse that he asked me about over and over and over was Romans 8:28. You know, what's that verse again? All things work together. I would quote it to him. It's like that was the extent of his interest. I got very frustrated because I just felt like I couldn't get anywhere. And in a lot of ways, he was a symbol of the spiritual temperature of his congregation. It was all about keeping up appearances. Let's make sure that the trim is painted. Let's make sure the light works. The sign, works. Let's make sure everything is put together. But why are we doing this? Why are we here? Well, because we're supposed to be a force for good in the community. That's kind of the thing, the kind of things he would say. But what actually drives the engine of this expression of the body of Christ? There was nothing. There was nothing. It's just an empty shell. Now, there's a beautiful contrast to this. In the city of Charlestown, New Hampshire, there's a church in the neighborhood or in a neighboring town that dwindled over the years, finally had to close its doors. And they hated the thought of this church getting torn down, this building, repurposed. And so this evangelical church in Charlestown, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it, but they bought the building. And they started a ministry that's now called the King's Table. And the vision comes from 2 Samuel 9. If you know the story, it's where King Saul had a grandson, Mephibosheth, which is one of those names that are almost impossible to pronounce, five times fast. But Mephibosheth was lame in his feet. He was dropped when he was a baby, and David found out about him, and he said, I want him to eat at my table for the rest of his life. I want him to be protected. Treated him as a part of his family. It's a beautiful picture of adoption. And so the King's Table is a church for those who are disabled, particularly adults. And so every week, from this church, this evangelical congregation, there are a huge number of volunteers that go to various group homes around that area and bring people and drive them over to this other to this old church building, and they do church. It's in the middle of the week because that's when they can get them there, and they have this wonderful service, and they do all kinds of things, and it's the antithesis of keeping up appearances, because if you've ever been... I mean, we have Hudson here. If you have somebody with disabilities, generally they make noises, they do things that, might be embarrassing. Just imagine a whole room full of people with disabilities. It's very loud. It's very chaotic. There's not a whole lot of an appearance, really, to keep up. But what is there is the gospel. That's the heart. That's what makes the church the church. And it's a beautiful picture. It's a beautiful reality that is making an impact in the lives of who Jesus called the least of these, my brothers and sisters. All right, second thing I want to show you. You have judgment on the darkness. I want to show you blessing despite the darkness. In chapter 15, verses 1 through 8, we meet Abijam, who is Rehoboam's son. And so let's read that now. Chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. Now in the 18th year of King Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, Abijam began to reign over Judah. He reigned for 3 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom. And he walked in all the sins that his father did before him, and his heart was not wholly true to the Lord his God as the heart of David his father. Nevertheless, for David's sake, the Lord his God gave him a lamp in Jerusalem, setting up his son after him and establishing Jerusalem, because David did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, and did not turn aside from anything that he commanded him all the days of his life, except in the matter of Uriah the Hittite. Now there was war between Rehoboam and Jeroboam all the days of his life. The rest of the acts of Abijam and all that he did, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? And there was war between Abijam and Jeroboam. And Abijam slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his place. All right, so I know this can be, there's a couple confusing things here. Abijah and Abijam are the same guy, just so you know. It's doubly confusing because Rehoboam has a son named Abijah, Abijam, and Jeroboam had a son named Abijah, Abijam. So you're not experiencing deja vu. This really happened, and they didn't consult each other, I guess, when they decided on their sons' names. But that, you know, just so you can understand. So this Abijah or Abijam gets very little coverage in 1 Kings. We learn more about him in Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, for example, that he led a great victory over Jeroboam's army. 500,000 of Israel's army was killed. And he did it by trusting God. This is really quite an amazing story. You don't hear that in 1 Kings. Because Chronicles was comparing Abijah to Jeroboam. Kings is comparing Abijah to David. Now, next to Jeroboam, Abijah looked pretty darn good. You know, he did seem to have some semblance of faith. Because in the time of testing, he came through. He trusted God. Compared to David, however, you know, he looks very bad. Because Abijah allowed all of these corrupt worship practices to continue. He allowed all this idolatry to continue. So, what, you know, did he truly trust God by faith? We don't really know. You know, you have evidence on both sides. But what's interesting in this little part of the passage is Abijah's not the story here. He's not the focus. David is the focus. And in spite of Abijah's failures, God was faithful to Judah. He did not allow them to be destroyed at this point. He certainly could have. Why? Why did he not allow them to be destroyed? Well, it says that God kept a lamp in Jerusalem. So the word for lamp, you know, not a physical lamp, but it's a symbol of progeny, of human posterity. Human beings will continue. God continued the dynasty of David for David's sake. Not because of David's faithfulness. Because as he points out here, most of the times when later writers talk about David, it's always in glowing terms. But here, you notice he said, David, who was a man after God's own heart, very godly, except in that little matter of Uriah. Which, when you read Samuel, it was not a little matter, it was a huge matter. It was a terrible breach of faithfulness to God. And so what we realize here is that God is not continuing David's dynasty because of David's faithfulness. He's continuing because of his promise. God is the one who said back in 2 Samuel 7, I'm going to make sure that there is always a king, a son of yours on the throne. And you definitely get the idea that there are going to be some bad apples in there. He said, when he strays from me, I will discipline him. But God promised that he was always going to remain faithful. Like it's like 2 Timothy 2:13 when Paul says, even when we are faithless, he remains faithful because he will not deny himself. He would never abandon his people. And we'll come back to this promise in a few minutes. All right, now let's get to the third section. This is hope amidst the darkness. Let's read chapter 15, verses 9 through 24. In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah, and he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maacah, the daughter of Abishalom, and Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done. He put away the male cult prostitutes out of the land and removed all the idols that his fathers had made. He also removed Maacah, his mother, from being queen mother because she had made an abominable image for Asherah. And Asa cut down her image and burned it at the brook Kidron. But the high places were not taken away. Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days, and he brought into the house of the Lord the sacred gifts of his father and his own sacred gifts, silver, gold, and vessels. And there was war between Asa and Baasha, king of Israel, all their days. Baasha, king of Israel, went up against Judah and built Ramah, that he might permit no one to go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. Then Asa took all the silver and the gold that were left in the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and gave them into the hands of his servants. And King Asa sent them to Ben-Hadad, the son of Tabrimon, the son of Hezion, king of Syria, who lived in Damascus, saying, let there be a covenant between you and me. as there was between my father and your father. Behold, I'm sending to you a present of silver and gold. Go, break your covenant with Baasha, king of Israel, that he may withdraw from me. And Ben-Hadad listened to King Asa and sent the commanders of his armies against the cities of Israel and conquered Ijon, Dan, Abel-Beth-Maacah, and Alchinaroth with all the land of Naphtali. And when Baasha heard of it, he stopped building Ramah and he lived in Tirzah. Then King Asa made a proclamation to all Judah. None was exempt, and they carried away the stones of Ramah and its timber with which Baasha had been building. And with them King Asa built Geba of Benjamin and Mizpah. Now the rest of all the acts of Asa, all his might, and all that he did, and the cities that he built, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Judah? But in his old age he was diseased in his feet. And Asa slept with his fathers, and was buried with his fathers in the city of David his father. And Jehoshaphat his son reigned in his place. All right, now we come to Asa, who's the son of Abijah. He became king after Asa's pretty short reign of 3 years. And he was a contrast in every other way, just about. He reigned twice as long as both his father and his grandfather put together. So what does that tell you? Well, generally, in the Old Testament, when somebody has a long reign, not always, but generally, it's a good sign. Now, I want to make one editorial note, because some of you detail-oriented people are going to say, hey, wait a minute, how did Asa and his father have the same mother? Did you notice that? Because it says that Abijah's mother was Maacah, and Asa's mother was Maacah. I'm pretty sure that biologically that's not possible. So most scholars believe that oftentimes you have someone referred to as a father when they're a grandfather. So this is kind of the same way, just on the maternal side. And so most of them believe that Maacah was Abijah's mother and Asa's grandmother. But she was still alive and she was still the queen mother at the beginning of Asa's reign. So we'll talk about her more in a minute. So Asa's the first king in either kingdom about whom it can be said that he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He had a heart like David. He got rid of the shrine prostitutes. He got rid of the stone pillars. He got rid of the Asherah poles. He even deposed his own grandmother from being queen mother. She was literally called Gebira, the big lady. Now, I don't know who came up with that name, but I wouldn't recommend it. But that's what they called her. And so he deposed her from her position as queen mother because she refused to give up her idolatry. Now, history tells us that this woman, Maacah, was actually the granddaughter of Absalom, who was David's rebellious son. So, here's where, insert cliche phrase, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. She did not have a godly heritage in terms of at least her immediate ancestors. But there's a great application here. Most of you know how difficult it is dealing with members of the family. How many of you have ever been in a family business, where you have other family members? It's hard dealing with conflict in the workplace. But in a family business, is that easier or harder? Just take a guess. Definitely harder. Can you imagine firing your grandmother from the family business? Not an easy thing. It took a lot of courage. And we learned that the queen mother had become, even at this early date, an actual title in Judah. She had her own crown, and she wielded a lot of power. And it didn't generally turn out to be a good idea. As we find later on, Maacah's example probably has some influence on a woman named Athaliah who actually seizes control. She seizes the crown itself. But we'll talk about that later. So Asa instituted some tremendous reforms of Judah's worship. He really took it back to what it was like early in Solomon's reign. It's a very godly man. His heart was wholly true to the Lord. The reforms were carried out in the first 10 years of his reign when he enjoyed a time of peace, which, interestingly enough, was due to Abijah's victory over Jeroboam. So, Abijah's, problematic as he was, really had an impact. 2 Chronicles 14 reports also that Asa led Judah to victory over Zerah the Ethiopian. He was actually a commander of the armies of Egypt, even though he was originally from Ethiopia. He had an army of a million men, and God led Asa in victory over him, not by Asa's, Asa's army was much smaller, but Asa cried out to God and said, please help me, and he did. 2 Chronicles 15 further tells us, in the 15th year of his reign, encouraged by the prophet Azariah, Asa convened an assembly in which all the true Israelites, those were Israelites not just in ethnicity but in their hearts, were invited to renew the covenant with the Lord. Pretty amazing stuff. So Asa was beyond the shadow of a doubt a godly king. So what's the moral of the story? Be like Asa, right? Well, not so fast. Verse 16 tells us the rest of the story. The time of peace eventually ended after Jeroboam and the short-lived reign of his son Nadab. Baasha began the second dynasty of Israel. This is the northern kingdom. And once he consolidated his power, he realized there was a problem. He was losing people constantly. They were defecting from the northern kingdom to the southern kingdom. Why, we were not told. But he didn't like this. You know, nobody wants people to be just leaving. And so he invaded Judah at a weak spot in their defenses, and he seized the town of Ramah, which was only 4 miles from Jerusalem. So he's right on the doorstep of the capital. And Ramah was a strategic location in a lot of ways. It cut off the road north out of Jerusalem, and it also was a key point in the eastern-western trade routes. And so this was a big deal. So what did Asa do? What did godly King Asa do? Did he cry out to God and pray? No, he didn't. He went to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, and he emptied the treasury and asked him to help. Now, Ben-Hadad was not a friend of Judah. You may remember that his father, really hated God's people with all of his heart. And probably Ben-Hadad was the same way. However, in their day, just like ours, money talks. And some of our English translations sugarcoat it. We read the ESV where he said, "I am giving you a gift." And there's, other translations call it a present. Well, it wasn't a gift. It wasn't a present. It was a bribe. We know what those are, right? The Hebrew is much more honest. So Asa tried to provide legal grounds for this arrangement by referring to a treaty between their fathers, but there's no real evidence that there ever was one. So he sends a bribe. He asks Ben-Hadad to break his covenant with Baasha, king of Israel. And what happened? Well, it worked. It was a brilliant strategy, and it worked like a charm. Ben-Hadad invaded Israel. Baasha had to leave what he was doing, and he had to go put out that fire. And while he was away, Asa's men came in and they dismantled everything that he built in Ramah, and they built up their own defenses. So all's fair in love and war, right? Great idea. Well, Ralph Davis, who you probably know, my favorite commentator, he put it really well when he said, "Success is no authentication of fidelity. The fact that something works doesn't necessarily mean it's good." And, we've talked about this in terms of the church, pragmatism, and, we don't necessarily choose whatever approach will get people in the seats under any circumstances. Asa's strategy accomplished its goal, but he did not please the Lord. And Chronicles records that the prophet Hanani condemned what Asa did because, A, he trusted in money rather than the Lord, right? Empties the treasury, doesn't go to God and ask for help. And B, he incites another king to break a covenant. Now, God values covenants. He doesn't care who the covenant is with. He doesn't take kindly to the breaking of covenants with anyone. And we have a couple of different examples in Ezekiel. Even with pagan kings, covenants are very, very important to the Lord. So how does Asa respond to Hanani, the prophet? He's speaking for God. Hanani says, "Hey, this is wrong. You got to stop." Asa throws him in jail. Godly King Asa. And Hanani becomes the first of many persecuted prophets. And then the other thing, besides sort of collateral damage, is that Ben-Hadad ends up getting control of the trade routes, which is going to cause a lot of problems later. So this appears to be the beginning of the end for Asa. He contracts a disease in his feet, about which Chronicles tells us he refused to seek the Lord. He only wanted to talk to the doctors. And he withered away for 2 years, and then he died. So what do we do with all this mess? We have two bad kings and one good king. And the bad king wasn't really totally bad, and the good king wasn't really totally good. And so you cannot look at this through the lens of moralism. and say, be like him, don't be like him. We'll sort of be like him. We'll be like this part of him, but not this part of him. We cannot use that lens. The truth is always more complicated. Rehoboam was pretty much evil through and through. But even Rehoboam attracted Levitical priests from the north to the south. There was some semblance of true worship that was going on at that time in the temple. Abijah, even though he was much like his father, he showed real courage when push came to shove, and even true faith in his battle with Jeroboam. And that battle gave Asa the 10 years of peace he needed to do all this good stuff. So, and then you look at Asa. Yes, he was a godly man and he had a heart for God. He was like David, but guess what? Like David, he showed some really significant lapses in judgment and in faith. So if there's a moral to this story, it would be something like, watch out who you put on a pedestal. Because what's going to happen when you put somebody on a pedestal? Inevitably, they will come crashing down. But here's the reality. This is not a story with a moral. It's a story with a gospel. And I'm really, really glad for that. Because we don't need a moral. We need a gospel. Both Israel and Judah, we found out, are headed for ruin. They're both headed down a highway that's going to end in exile. But into that darkness, God shines his lamp. And this is his commitment to the family of David, as screwed up and flawed as they are. And there's another son of David, a greater son of David, that's not going to be, it's going to be different from all these flawed leaders. And he's going to succeed where they failed. And the God who was in the process of preparing him to come could be trusted with his people. There's a great illustration of this. There was a spiritual revival in Wales in 1859. And the year before that revival, someone said, they put it this way, the churches are withering away. There's a wave of spiritual apathy and practical infidelity that has spread over Wales. So that was before the revival. A year after, or in the year after the revival, the number of criminal cases before the Welsh courts dropped by 30%. And the revival solidly affected 100,000 people, which was a tenth of the population. Most of these conversions standing the test of time. In other words, these weren't people that showed up in the church and then disappeared. These were people that continued. Now, you know, we look around at our culture. It's not really that much different from Israel and Judah, is it? I know the gods are different. The idols are different. Just kind of forget about that part. The idolatry is there. And we're not that much different from Wales in 1858. The church seems ineffective at times, doesn't it? It seems shallow. In many cases, it seems weak. It seems small. And yet, the God who brought Asa when he was needed still exists. He's still working, and he's working here in this region of New England that where it just seems like there's a lot of darkness, and it seems like it's overwhelming. And the God who brought that revival in Wales can do it again. And you know what? We pray for revival, but I don't know about you, but I get tired of it, and I stop. But let's not. Because, you know, he can do it again. God is the central figure in this story. And God has a relentless pursuit of people. And he can intervene. He can revive. He can restore. He can renew. Let's not give up praying for that. Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we thank you that we thank you for the lives of these men, these kings. They're not mere examples of what to do and what not to do, but they really give us a wonderful picture of how the beauty of the gospel shines in dark places. And Lord, there are dark places in other parts of the world, and we live in a dark place too. But we carry in our hearts the light that your word tells us one day will fill the whole earth. So Lord, help us not to give up. Help us not to stop praying. Give us the endurance and the encouragement in each other, and give us the desire just to share the good news that has changed our lives. And Lord, now would you please feed us by the sacrament in Jesus' name. Amen.